Hey, small town fam. It's Yardley. How are you guys? I hope you're all well. We have a great episode for you today. Well, let me just qualify that. Saying anything is great on this podcast always feels a little odd because we talk about the most horrible things. And today's case is no exception. It involves multiple sexual assaults. So what I mean is the way this case gets solved is great. And I remember when we were recording this episode, the fact that our guest, retired Detective Constable Simon, the fact that he was able to turn chaos into order made me feel a tiny bit safer. Of course, as always, we are sparing in the graphic details of what the offender in this case actually did to his victims. But there's no way to tell this story without mentioning some of those details, because it is Simon's fine-toothed comb assessment of how this attack he's focusing on was carried out that leads him to catch the bad guy. The PS to this story is, everyone else at Simon's small Scottish agency told him he was barking up the wrong tree, he had the wrong guy, and by the way, everyone in the small island town of Rothsay also already knew who the offender was. The cops just couldn't catch him. Simon takes all this into account, but his spidey sense tells him something is off. So he vows to investigate until he proves himself right or wrong. Here is the penny drop. Hi there, I'm Yardley.
I'm Dan.
I'm Dave.
And I'm Paul.
And this is Small Town Dicks.
Dave and I are identical twins
and retired detectives from Small Town USA.
And I'm a veteran cold case investigator who helped catch the Golden State Killer using a revolutionary DNA tool.
Between the three of us, we've investigated thousands of crimes, from petty theft to sexual assault, child abuse to murder.
Each case we cover is told by the detective who investigated it, offering a rare, personal account of how they solved the crime.
Names, places, and certain details have been changed to protect the privacy of victims and their families.
And although we're aware that some of our listeners may be familiar with these cases, we ask you to please join us in continuing to protect the true identities of those involved
out of respect for what they've been through.
Thank you.
Today on Small Town Dicks, my friends, we have the A-Team. The A-Team of usual suspects. We have Detective Dan.
Hello.
Hello. We have Detective Dave.
Happy to be here.
Oh, I'm happy to have you here, as always. And of course, we have the one and only Paul Holes.
Hey, hey, how's it going?
Hey. I'm so jealous. The three fellas are all together at one table, and I am miles away at my own table. It's lonely over here. But somebody had to make the donuts this week, and that was me. And Small Town fam, we are so pleased to welcome a new guest to the podcast. You're going to recognize that this fella is not from here. He's from quite far away over the pond. We have retired Detective Constable Simon.
Hello there. How are you?
I'm so good. I don't know if our listeners can tell, but obviously you're not from L.A.
From Bonnie Scotland.
Indeed. And you come to us from one of our favorite guests who's been on the podcast many times, Mr. Tom Wood.
Yes, retired deputy chief constable of Lothian and Borders Police.
Yes, indeed. So, Simon, I will ask you to give us just a thumbnail of your career.
Well, back in the 70s, I was 19 years of age. I was working in a shipyard at the time in Glasgow, very much with a trade in mind. In the UK at that time, we were very much in industrial turmoil and change. The Margaret Thatcher government was just coming on. Industrialisation was being decimated all over the UK. The mining industries, the heavy metal industries, shipbuilding, all that industry was being decimated. And the unions were being squashed throughout that period. And they were advertising for police officers. Naively, I thought that was to pound the beat. It was actually to man the picket lines, etc., of all this civil turmoil that was going on. So there were lots of us joining at the same time as well. And I went through the process, much to the shock of my friends and family, who couldn't understand why the police would want to recruit someone like me. And they did. Eventually, I served my 2 years in uniform and then did my aide to the CID and then became a detective in the October with almost 3 years' service. For the purposes of this story, I was a detective constable. I was a young detective.
Great. So, Simon, please tell us how this case came to you.
It was certainly an influential case in my career and certainly an eye-opener for me in lots of ways. And I think once I've told you, we'll all realise that it speaks to a few truths about the police service worldwide and the things that drive investigations and how those investigations can be knocked off track very, very easily. It happened in about 1981 on the Isle of Bute, an island just off the west coast of Scotland. Some people might recognise the town of Rothesay, which is the capital of the Isle of Bute. To put you in the picture, the Isle of Bute has a population of 6,000 and Rothesay itself has about 4,000. And there's no way on or off the Isle of Bute other than by boat. And there's two services, but those tend to finish at dark, really. So after a certain time at night, you're stuck there. So you get the idea. There was only one detective on the island. There was a 24-hour uniform presence, a shift of four or five men in each shift. I was posted as a very, very young detective.
Were you excited to go to this little island? Did that seem like a step up or sort of like, oh God, what am I going to do in the winter evenings, for instance?
As a young cop, moving there was very exciting for all of us, for the family, because I had a young wife and a baby. It was a recognition as a young cop that you could do that, that you could go and work unsupervised as a detective. In an environment like that was quite an accolade for a young man like that. I don't know if any of the guys can relate to this, but it showed that someone had noticed you, someone had taken some note of you from the hierarchy. And if you think about where I was working, the hierarchy were a couple of hundred miles away in police headquarters. But here was a message coming down that young McLean could go and do this job. So yeah, it was very exciting, Yardley, very.
That's fantastic. And so if you're the new guy and you're the only detective on this small force, were the other four or five fellows who were uniform cops, did they welcome you? And had they been there for years and years? What was the setup?
It was a kind of mixture of both. There's four and five cops on each shift. So you're talking about in total 20 to 24, including sergeants, inspector and a chief inspector that was based there, plus civilian staff. So you're probably talking about 30 staff at that police office in Rothesay to police the island of Bute 24/7. So it was a kind of mixed reception because I really was a young buck. I was talking about this with Tom Wood just recently, that I was looking at an old photograph, a detective training photograph from 1976. And Yardley, I thought it was a retirement course that they were on. These were new detectives being trained, and I don't think there was one of them under 40 years of age. I don't know how that would translate across the pond, but in the UK, the police were very traditional back in those days. Everything was dead man's shoes, if that makes any sense.
What is that expression? That's great.
You're waiting for someone to pass away or retire or whatever before there's a promotion. So really, it's all about seniority and how long you've been in the job that dictates everything. And here was a young buck at 25 years of age being made detective in a place like the Isle of Bute, where I was the only detective. The young guys of my age that were there, young cops, because remember, we were recruiting like mad when I joined. There was lots and lots of us. That was counterbalanced by, as you referred to, the older hands, the sergeants and whatnot, some of whom had been in the job for 25, 30 years. And they totally resented this young buck coming on board as a detective, because there would be a pecking order that I was reasonably aware of, that who was next in line to become the detective. Because in those days, it had nothing to do with ability or ambition or suitability. It was to do with who was next in line.
So, Simon, what sort of crimes were occurring on this little island?
The answer to that is every crime that you get everywhere else in the world, because crime is crime and people are people. And we'd have theft, we'd have shoplifting, we'd have serious assault, we'd have drink offences, drunk driving, we'd have sexual assaults, domestic abuse. there's nothing I could say here that we don't have everywhere. It's just the scale of it is different because of the size of population. And the dynamic's slightly different because, as they say in small towns, everybody knows everybody. And everybody knows everybody's business as well, which is fantastic for a detective. So it's that environment I'm trying to get across to you, where we're isolated. We can only get off the island limited times a day. Strangers stick out a mile on the island. You'd notice strangers immediately. So that's the dynamic that we're talking about, is that kind of small town mentality we're dealing with. And the police, some of them having been there their whole careers, have got the same small town mentality.
Right.
On my first day, my immediate supervisor, Detective Inspector Roddy MacDonald, who lived and worked in Lochgilphead, about 50 miles away from Rossie, he came over specially my first day and gave me a tour of the police station, introduced me to the chief inspector, introduced me to the cleaners and the civilian staff, the typist, much more important people than any of the cops, that's for sure, and whatever shift was on, showed me my office, which was like a suite with my desk and all that, and a dark room that I could do my own photography and develop my own photographs for scenes of crime purposes. So I had everything. I was self-sufficient there. And while he was doing that, he showed me the desk, talking to me about Rossie, and there was an egg box lying underneath one of the tables.
Like what you get a dozen eggs in?
No, a big box that you would get a dozen eggs in.
A
big cardboard box, about maybe 2 foot or bigger, and about 18 inches tall and about 18 inches wide. So a big box that you would use if you were moving house, something along those lines. And it was covered over, the lid was on, and I said, "What's in the big egg box?" And he sighed. He said, "Oh, Simon." And he brought it out, and it was covered in dust. I remember him blowing it to get the dust off it, and he put it on the desk, and he said, "This is the Contini box." I said, "What do you mean, what's Contini?" And he said, "It's a guy that you'll get to know very well," and I did get to know him very well. His name was Charles Contini, and he lived on the island. Remember I said all the crime that you get? You've always got a gangster. He was the most violent man on the island, without any question. He was the kind of godfather on the Isle of Bute. I'm kind of making light of it there, but it's the same in any community where people live and work and get on with their daily lives. And although the crime rate, there was maybe about 40 crimes a month, of which I was detecting about 80-odd%, which is unheard of, other than in small communities like that, those crimes were just as important and impacted just as much on the community and the people that lived in the community, the elderly people, the shopkeepers, the business people. Those crimes have just as big an impact as they would in Glasgow or London or any city in the world. It's the community that's the important part.
So what kinds of crimes were in the egg box?
So this egg box happened to have over 130 undetected crime reports in it. And every one of them ranged from attempt rape to indecent assault, right down to flashing. Would you call it flashing over there? Somebody flashing themselves to women in private places. Most of them had happened within a half-mile radius in woods that were just outside Rossie, between Rossie and a place called Port Bannintyne on the Isle of Bute. But nothing had happened for the last, I think it was 20 months, and this is why they were lying in an egg box now. And what the DI told me was that Contini was responsible. And when I said, "Well, has he been locked up?" He said, "No, we can never get him. Nobody will give us a statement about him because he is who he is. And he's violent and threatening. We know it's him, no question. The descriptions, everything that they had pointed towards him. They had interviewed him, I don't know how many times. I interviewed him half a dozen times and never got a word out of him, ever. But that was great. That's why I interviewed him, because I find that very incriminating when they do that. Mr. Contini was a piece of work. And everyone that I spoke to about Contini knew that he was responsible for all these crimes in the egg box.
Wow. And had Contini grown up on this island?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. He was a local. And he reveled in his reputation that he had got through use of his fist. And he had his usual entourage of hangers-on and minions that would do his beckoning. And he was feared. There's no question of that. He was feared because he was quite ruthless.
And how old was he roughly when he comes across your desk?
A bit older than me. I'd say in his late 20s, maybe 30, married.
How did Contini make his money? Did he run drugs? Was it prostitution? Did he just steal things?
If I said all of the above, would you guys know what I mean? Yeah, anything that you can turn your hands to. Obviously drugs, because that's the name of the game. In a place like that, he had all the levers to pull as far as that was concerned. And I don't think there would be anybody dealing drugs without his consent or say-so and paying him off in some way. So yeah, there wouldn't be anything going on that he didn't know about and be sanctioning in some way.
So your first day, you get introduced to this huge box of previous criminal reports. And this guy's a menace to the entire island. And at that point, that your supervisor says, hey, this is all yours? Or did you just take it on yourself and say, well, I'm going to crack open these cases?
Well, I put it back where it came from and hoped I would never see it again. That's the truth of the matter. And it lay there for another year because there hadn't been an incident for 20 months that could be linked to those series. You guys know what I mean when I talk about linking. It's not every case that you would link quickly to each other because that detracts from the overall inquiry. Everything's taken on its own merits. So for 130-odd of these cases to be linked like that, there was obviously very, very strong evidence where the locus was very close, where the descriptions were very close, where the MO was very similar, enough to say, this is the same guy. The problem was that they had made up their mind who that guy was, and I was quite happy to go along with that and got on with my work for the next year, my first year in Rossi, which was very eventful. And about a year later, I got a phone call at home one night from a wizened old sergeant in Rossi, Willie Young, who had been there his whole career, I think. And Willie phoned me and said, Simon, I think you should come down for a chat and see this. I said, Willie, what is it? You've got all sorts of cops on tonight and a policewoman. He said, it's an indecent assault, but I'm not happy about it. Because it was Willie, I was there within 10 minutes because he wouldn't phone me for no reason. And sure enough, he was sitting really sad at his desk because he had been involved in the whole Contini inquiries over the years. They had brought detectives over from the mainland. They had brought policewomen over and put them undercover to try and capture Contini, to try and get him to commit a crime when we were watching. They had done all of that. Willie said to me, I think Contini's back at his old business. He explained to me that two young girls had been walking up a path in the area that maybe 50% of these crimes had occurred in over the years, when a guy had jumped out from the woods, grabbed one of them from behind and proceeded to sexually assault her. He had held the girl with his right hand and had touched her with his left hand, while her friend, thankfully, had the presence of mind to run and scream at the top of her voice for help. It was just getting dark, which was always the time of night that it happened at, that twilight time of night. It was in the secluded area where you wouldn't really expect anyone to be out. And it only lasted less than a minute, and he was off. What the doctor told us was he must be a nail biter because his nails were sharp.
Oh, the offender was a nail biter?
Yes, and when he touched the wee girl at private parts, he had lacerated the wee girl in that area. And that's what the doctor's conclusion was.
These are like ambush, hurried, frenzied type attacks.
Yes. There had been lots of others in the box that weren't as frenzied. Bearing in mind this was the first for 20 months, I think that's what we put it down to at first. It was more about a message to us than it was a serious attempt at rape or whatever. Why would you pick two girls, you know, when one of them, you can only grab one. There was lots of things about it that looked as though it was exactly the same person. In fact, everything indicated it was the same person that had perpetrated all the ones the years before. And this was him active again. And if it's Contini, the consensus was, I'm saying if it was, there was absolutely no doubt who had done this. In the minds of my bosses, the uniform sergeants, the uniform cops, my wife who spoke to her friends and neighbours, everybody on the island knew who had done this, except me.
The two girls who were ambushed by this man and the one who was assaulted, were they also familiar with Contini and therefore could identify him, say, yes, I know it was that guy?
Very much so. The one who was attacked wasn't much use. She didn't see him. but the one that ran away had looked back briefly. So she'd given us a good description. So the next day, there's a routine to go through to make the public feel safe. There's more cops in the street. There's detectives on the island. The chief inspector came over initially as well from Dumbarton near Glasgow. And I've got a DS, a detective sergeant from Dunoon, who's there now as well, plus a few detective constables that have been brought in so that the public get reassured that the police are on the job. And the DI, the detective inspector, Roddy McDonald, brought Cantini in. He interviewed Cantini the next day. They got nowhere, possibly because that was their expectation in the first place. And him and DS Clark went and spoke to the two girls with the families. So I was totally outranked there.
Simon, these girls are describing the attacker. Was there any unusual feature that really stood out, made him have a unique look, a tattoo, the types of clothing, anything along those lines?
The person that did this always wore dark clothing. Sometimes during the 130-odd attacks, he had wore a balaclava over his face, but not on this occasion. He had a hood, he had an anorak, and a slight growth, slight stubble, and that was the description. No jewellery, nothing untoward. The only thing that I got that I was going to explain to you was he was left-handed. And that was me that decided that, because I got her to show me exactly what had happened. The other girl, the same, independently, show me exactly. And it was always the right hand across her and the left hand touching her. And I just couldn't get it out of my head that you wouldn't do that with your wrong hand. I'm left-handed as well, which maybe played a part of it.
Oh, interesting.
The thought I was having is, here you have a very strong suspect in this case. At what point within your system do you have what we would call probable cause in order to effect an arrest? It sounds like you're lacking the elements in order to be able to arrest and charge Charles Cantini with this crime.
Yep. I had all the probable cause. I got a warrant and went and searched Cantini's house and took just about every piece of clothing that he had. And we had the girls' clothing as well. I was looking for the simplest trace to put them at the locus, and that would have solved every single crime in that box as far as I was concerned. But this had all been done many, many times. And as you'll learn as the story goes on, it was never going to prove fruitful. So after I searched his house and took his clothes, he came in to complain into the police station, to complain about harassment or whatever it was. I'd had a warrant to do everything that I did. I took him down to my office. And on the way down, I stopped and turned round and put my hand out to shake his hand.
To Cantini?
Yeah. And his face was almost as shocked as yours is right now, Yardley, because he got the fright of his life as well, and he didn't know what to do. And he took my hand, and his grip was quite a grip, and I pulled him in close, and he didn't know what was going on. The first thing was, I established without doubt that he did not bite his nails. His nails were manicured, I would say. The main thing was that I was inches from him and he wasn't going to blink. And I said to him, Cantini, you didn't attack any wee girls, did you? And I knew right away he was never going to tell me anything at all. He just smiled. He just smirked and he relaxed. The violence dropped because he thought we were going to go for it there and then. But for that fleeting second, I was looking in his eyes. I knew it wasn't him. I knew for a fact that he was taking the mickey.
No kidding.
Does that sound too intuitive?
No,
because it feels that way now, relating it 40-odd years later. But at the time, I was almost the same age as him. I had built up a wee relationship with him at this point because of other crimes that I dealt with. Not a good relationship by any stretch of the imagination. But I'd like to think there was a kind of mutual respect there, if that makes any sense. And if you look someone in the eyes properly, you can usually tell if there's an honesty there or a dishonesty there. You don't always know why or what it's about.
Simon, I completely agree with you. I think that the skills you develop over the years of being an investigator and being a police officer, you talk to so many people that your skills evolve. And it's just interpersonal skills, it's social skills, and being able to read a room. But we've all got experience with people being dishonest with us. So I think that when you know someone's being dishonest, I think it's easier to figure out when someone's being honest with you.
Exactly.
So what info did you have?
So we'd gone down all those avenues and the description we had was very good. And again, the girls were maybe tainted by this illusion that it was Cantini. End of story. Everybody knew. The ferryman that drove the ship, I remember him talking to me. Must be terrible not being able to catch Cantini. Everybody knew who it was. And that very simple thing that we can laugh at now undermined everything else that should have been happening, including the identification. The great thing about people coming for 2 or 3 days to help with an inquiry, they go for a drink at night and they catch up and then they want to go home. The night before they went away, I remember sitting with the DI, with Roddy McDonald and Jim Clark, the DS. And during the conversation, when we're all enjoying a pint, a drink, I said to them, has anyone ever thought of the possibility that it might not be Cantini? I can remember this as if it was yesterday, because I was only a very, very young detective, and here's me coming up with an idea. And they both looked at me, and one of them said, what do you mean? And I explained about the left-handed. I knew Cantini was right-handed. He was quite an accomplished artist. Cantini was definitely right-handed, and I thought that the person that did this must be left-handed. The person that did this to the wee girl and assaulted her had sharp nails, and I knew for a fact that Cantini never ever had these things that were bothering me. I remember the DI kind of, okay, son, do what you've got to do. And then they carried on with the conversation as if I hadn't said anything.
Not exactly a vote of confidence.
So we had a drink that night. They went away. And the next day, I went and saw my immediate boss in Rossi, who's a detective chief inspector, Mr. Gillis. And I told him my misgivings, these things that were bothering me. But he said to me, Simon, you do what you've got to do to satisfy yourself. And you've got my sanction to do that. But there's no overtime, remember? That was always the add-on at the end of anything. There was never any overtime. So that's what I did, Yardley. I took it on myself to look at it from a fresh perspective. That's all. I took the blinkers off that everyone else had on. But I wasn't saying they were wrong. I was saying, let's have a fresh look at it. And what clinched it for me was that I went and saw the family and I got the girl who had given the description. And I took her out in the police car as a policewoman, and we drove about for a bit. And then I drove past where I knew Mr. Cantini was standing. And as we drove past afterwards, she said, you've just driven me past Cantini, haven't you? I said, yeah, is that him? And she said, I know Cantini, Mr. McLean, and it's not this guy, but he's very, very like him. She said, I had to look twice to make sure it wasn't him. Nobody had ever thought to question this identification. And that just set so many triggers going in my head that there was someone that looked very, very like our man Cantini. And to my mind, he had to be related. And that's when my inquiries really started.
How old was this girl that was in the police car? She's the one who ran away, right? And looked over her shoulder and glanced back at the suspect.
Yes.
About how old were those girls?
From memory, 12, 13. Schoolgirls. And her saying it wasn't Cantini was a fantastic identification because it ruled out Cantini totally. It's not him. She was brought up in the island. She probably saw Cantini most days. She'd certainly see him regularly and knew who he was. And she is saying, it's not him.
It's fascinating. Her qualifier was, it's not him, but it looked so much like him, is the thing that seems like set you down the next part of the journey.
Yeah, totally. Because what I had to do was go and get out all those 130-odd cases and start looking at descriptions and start looking at everything. And what I did was create an anacapa, we call it. I suppose that's worldwide, where I put it on my wall. Remember all that space I told you about I had in my office? Well, it came in handy because I used a whole wall and started doing a family tree. Now, anyone that's done a family tree will know how tricky this is, that you can only go by the public record. I suppose it's much different now with DNA and whatnot. But if anything's true of families, there's a public side to that and there's a private side to that. And that was the real detective work that went on, trying to find out Cantini's relatives that I could get in touch with and eliminate or otherwise from the inquiry. So you can imagine the task. I was a pain to the record keepers, the register office, where everyone registers the births and marriages, etc., etc. These were the tools that we had in these days prior to the internet. We couldn't go online and do these things. We had to do the footwork. A lot of cooperation from the library, from all sorts of people. This Anna Kappa revealed that there were lots of avenues to go down from this family. Contini's family had come over here in the 50s, as it transpired. And some members of his family were very well-respected business people on the island. So there was this whole family tree and what goes on behind that, that parents and grandparents and great-grandparents knew about, but was never discussed. I was on my own, remember, and it's a bit like writing a book. It's a peculiar experience that you have to self-motivate all the time. And there's still the normal day-to-day work going on. And everyone is telling me what an idiot I am.
I was going to say, it's a lonely place in a police station or in a detective bureau when you're the only person who subscribes to a particular hypothesis or theory. And you get mocked.
Yes, totally. Don't be so stupid. Or ignored. Even worse, ignored. They're coming down to have a look at this Anna Kappa, wondering what I'm playing at. The DI had come over for a visit and seen what I was doing, and he just shook his head and went away, wondering if I was mad. And really, the break in the case came when I went and spoke to one of the Contini relatives, one of the more respected business owners in the town of Rossi. And I made an appointment with him. I sat him down and explained to him what I was doing and that I was going to get to the bottom of it. But there was some blockage there that I couldn't quite fill in a blank of. And he told me a story about a child who was born out of wedlock. Quite a common story, this, back in the day, back in the 40s. It was such a disgrace to the family and such a disgrace to the religious family and all the rest of it that the baby was given away. This baby had been adopted and had grown up elsewhere. And this was the guy who was to become my main suspect. His name was Paul Baxter. And from there, I knew what school he had gone to. I knew his background, date of birth, everything fell into place then. And I could track him down and discovered that he'd joined the army, become a soldier.
This is a Contini family relative?
Yes, Paul Baxter. Would be a second cousin of Contini. He was a bit older than our Contini. And he was in the army now. That was an added complication because my next job was to try and hone in on him. Because at this stage, you're still trying to eliminate people, if that makes any sense. At this point, I'm not thinking this is my guy. I'm thinking I hope this is my guy. So the first job always is to try and eliminate him because it's only through doing that that you discover you can't. So I'm thinking, well, he's in the army. Where's he posted? Where was he working? Could he have been in Rossi at the times of these offences? Because remember, they stretched over six-year period by this time. And it's never easy to get information from Her Majesty's forces because they don't give out information willy-nilly. And you guys will know that over there as well. The one thing the forces did do for me before I had to get the heavyweights involved was to establish where Paul had been in the world. And that's what clinched it for the full-scale inquiry thereafter, because he had been off sick for a long period of time. The guy wasn't well. He had psychological problems and he had been on leave at certain times and he had been posted in the UK for a short space of time as well. So all of that gave him opportunity for all of the crimes that I was looking at, including the one that I had just investigated a few weeks prior.
So you were able to establish that Paul was on your little island when those two girls were, when one of them was assaulted and the other one ran away.
I couldn't put him on the island at that point, but I could say that he could have been on the island because he wasn't at his army barracks.
Ah, okay.
And that's where the team comes in now. Up until then, I was the only person in the world thinking that anything could not be associated with Contini. But now that I had a suspect, it was a different ballgame entirely. So I enrolled the help of the Procurator Fiscal and police headquarters to try and get some headway politically with the forces. So it was a whole new ballgame, but they pursued that while I got some manpower allocated to start going through the case file and start to try and trace witnesses that might be able to identify him after all this time.
Simon, so your command staff, the people who are kind of in your orbit, superiors, people who come over and help out on the case, now the perception is beginning to change. And how is that received by those folks? Do they realize, oh my God, we've had this wrong the whole time?
Strangely enough, it was never something that I brought up. It wasn't a case of, for goodness sake, you lot, you really messed this up. That never really came out. I think it was unspoken. Now, I've no doubt they had grave misgivings about it, because these weren't bad people or bad detectives or bad anything. These were good guys doing their jobs. They had just fallen into that trap of blinkeredness, a comfort zone where everybody knows that's the case, and then there's no need to question it, and everybody just gets on with their life. People in those days, in the 70s, in the police, they were very conservative, if that's the right word, and that's, I'm not using that politically. So my DI would never give me a hug or anything, you know. He would never really say, that's a great job, Simon. He might send me something in writing to that effect that hinted at that, but there's usually be a but afterwards, you know. So they were never very effusive with each other. And you guys know about the banter. That's the same in the police and the CID, and anything else is seen as weakness kind of thing, you know. It would maybe be, aye, well done, son. I'll buy you a wee whiskey for that. Well done. And that would be the end of it. That would be the most you would ever hear. So nobody came over and started crying and saying, oh, I messed up or anything like that.
Right. There's just a quiet understanding and a mutual respect.
How can you say that in one sentence and I've rambled on for the last 5 minutes?
So, Simon, you've identified the suspect as Paul Baxter, and it sounds like you actually have quite a bit of information on him.
Yes, got his name. I know who his mum and dad are, and I've got some of the adopted family as well who were in Scotland but not on the island. So I've got as much information as I need about him. Interestingly, his fingerprints weren't on file. So Paul Baxter wasn't on file. He had no previous convictions in Scotland, which was an added complication for us. It's maybe why he'd never come to the fore. And none of the family knew about him. This was the thing. Nobody had been covering up for him. He wasn't known about because it had been a family secret.
Wow. What happens? Do you get to bring him over and have a chat with this Paul Baxter?
If only. If only. What you always do with cases like this, that have got international repercussions and 136 unsolved cases, I went to the Procurator Fiscal, the DI came with me, and we put a plan in place to start the political efforts that would need to be made to deal with this at that level. And I started putting together the evidence to present to the Fiscal to get a warrant, to get him brought over for an ID parade. We never got to go and arrest him, unfortunately.
Why not?
Well, the forces brought him to us in handcuffs.
When you finally met Paul Baxter, did he have anything to say for himself?
No. No.
Of course not.
It's always a disappointment. It's always a letdown. I don't know how the other guys feel about this. You build it up in your mind. I had spent a few months on this, sacrificing time that I should have been doing other things. So it becomes a big, big deal in your head. There's an old saying that you should never meet your heroes because it's going to be a disappointment. And it's a wee bit like that, that you've got this monster in your head, you know, who's attacked, that you know of 134 women. So he must be violent, he must be a big guy. Paul was just a wee small man, insignificant, couldn't look at you, couldn't have any eye contact with anyone, head down. I don't think he ever looked at me that I noticed. Wouldn't respond to questions. Very, very nervous individual who was probably as much a victim as anyone in this if we really looked into his background and upbringing. But he certainly had a history of mental illness, instability, depression. Remember the nail biting? He was always biting his nails. He was left-handed. All fell into place.
That must be such a great feeling.
Yeah. So I put together the 136 cases and we managed to get in touch with about 70 of them. A lot of them refused to speak to us at all because time moves on. People go and get married, they go and have children, they go and get on with their lives. So part of it is people want to forget about this incident that happened when they were on holiday or whatever it might have been. And the other part is that they don't want their new family or their new husband or their fiancé or whatever to know about it at all. They'd rather just move on. So you lose a lot of witnesses that way. But we still had plenty to work with. And I'll tell you the figures roughly off the top of my head. We managed to go and get statements from 40-something. So that was a big task, travelling from Rossie. Some of them local, not very many. At the end of the day, we had 14 women, I think two were local, so 12 that were prepared to travel to Rossy on a Sunday afternoon to view an identification parade. Nowadays, a formal ID parade is done using a screen in a room that's specifically designed and built for an identification parade. We didn't have that in Rossy, so we had to resort to the old-fashioned method of you're looking at the guys in front of you, and they've all got a number at their feet on the floor. So it's a bit confrontational, but there's lots of police officers there. And remember that six or seven of these guys are innocent stand-ins, we call them. And the witness has to walk along that line and look at each individual face. Whatever the answer is has to be noted verbatim. And that's what we hope to do with Mr. Baxter.
How many of the 14 that went through this lineup process, how many identified Paul Baxter as the suspect?
8 of them identified him positively, including the wee girl from the last case.
That's pretty good.
From 130 odd, it doesn't sound much, but given the time period and the type of crimes that we were talking about, and a lot of these women that we contacted, I'm maybe being unfair in saying they didn't want to come forward, a lot of them could never identify him. Here's a guy jumping out the woods, jumping out a bush in the dark or almost dark and assaulting you, horrific assault. They'd no idea. They maybe got an impression of size, maybe got an impression of age, of the length of his hair or whatever it might be, but only impressions, not great descriptions. So a lot of them could never have identified him. But 8 was plenty for our purposes. And it was the tip of the iceberg, as it transpires. So predators like him don't confine their activities to one location. So it turned into a much, much bigger inquiry than just our wee island. Paul had been all over Europe by this point. There was more cases in Germany than there had been in Rossy.
You have this 18-month pause in a series of attacks. I'm like, Baxter's either in prison or he's somewhere else. He must have been just a menace throughout the army, wherever he was posted.
Yeah. The only surprising thing for me, and I don't know this, was that it hadn't escalated. It's like domestic abuse. It starts off with a push and then maybe a punch 3 months later, but it escalates. It only goes one way. And it's the same with these type of crimes. It's the same with serial criminals, that they tend to push the boat out more and more as they go. And if he did that, I didn't get to the bottom of that because it was taken from my hands. It was an Interpol and other police forces and probably the Army's own investigation. But it was good to get him off the street anyway, put it that way.
I'm curious that if Baxter was having mental health issues in the Army, that they let him come back after his leaves of absence. Do you know anything about that?
I don't know anything about it at all. And they're the last people that are going to discuss that with you, because none of us like to think of our soldiers running about with mental health problems. But I think it's probably the sad truth. In fact, I read somewhere recently that we've got 150,000 in our forces just now. And at any one time, there's 10,000 on sick leave.
Wow. I mean, it makes perfect sense. As with first responders, it's a not normal way to spend your day under that much stress 24/7. It's just not.
Yeah.
So, Simon, did Paul Baxter go to trial?
Yeah. Went to a jury trial, but he never gave evidence or anything. He never really gave a defense. Paul was found guilty of all 8 assaults and he was convicted. I don't think the fiscal brought all the other ones to the trial. I think the decision from our Crown, we call it the Crown, who are our prosecution service, I think they didn't want to muddy the waters for the jury. I think they wanted to keep it short and sharp and sweet because there was bigger fish to fry at that point. So he got medical reports. And I suppose he was hospitalised. I don't remember now. He got a sentence, but I'm sure it started off with him being hospitalised for medical background reports and whatnot.
Do you think after Baxter is committed to an institution of some sort, did Germany then extradite him and say, now we're going to hold you accountable for the assaults in our country?
Yes. That's my belief, that what happened afterwards. Not just Germany either. It was right across Europe. Wherever he had been posted, there's an old saying in the police that the inquiry start once you lock up the suspect, you know, once you lock up the accused. And that was very much the case here, because now that you've got someone who's a predator, obviously very active, a very distinctive MO, modus operandi, you can start going through the records and look at where he's been posted, which I wasn't party to. I know that he was in Germany. I don't know where. I'm thinking he was a driver, so he could have been in a lot of places across the continent. But the forces would be able to put a lot of that together, where he had stayed and what he'd been doing. And then in conjunction with the local police, find their egg box under their young detective's desk, lying in the office with dust on it, and start going through their egg boxes respectively.
Simon, you got on to Baxter largely because you had that witness when you drove her by Charles Contini, and she says, that's not him, but he looks like him. When you finally saw Paul Baxter, how much did he look like Charles Contini?
Very much. It could have been his twin.
Wow.
Wow.
Incredible. It's like twins. Once you know who's who, you're all right.
I still get confused with these two.
You know what I mean? At first glance, you would think it was him. And that gives everybody an out to a degree. I can understand why it was so convenient to blame Charles Contini. And he was a rascal anyway. I want to swear here and call him what he really was.
But as you said, Contini is sort of riding high on the assumption that he's responsible for these assaults, and he knows that he hasn't done it. And so he gets to capitalize on that brutal reputation.
Yeah, he gets all the kudos of being able to take the mickey out of the police or whatever it might be.
It's interesting that Charles and Paul, that didn't grow up together, end up having hugely criminal backgrounds. And you think, is that genetic? Or is it just a coincidence? It's kind of interesting how they both just turned into bad people.
Well, Baxter didn't have previous convictions. He was jumping from bushes, sometimes with a balaclava over his head, and flashing, doing all the things that perverts would do to get a thrill.
Paul, I did want to ask you, it's curious to me that this Baxter, his sexual assaults, at least as far as we know, never escalated, right? I mean, not that they're not awful, but it didn't lead to rape and then murder. Do you have any thoughts about that?
Well, you know, there's an entire spectrum of offender types, like what we saw with Joseph DeAngelo, you know, the classic evolution going from, you know, the peeping Tom to somebody who's breaking into houses to somebody who's committing rapes and then ultimately homicides. However, there are some offenders that just kind of stall within that evolution. And it really comes down to their own psychology, what they really are fantasizing about, what they need to get out of the crime. And so with Paul Baxter, not knowing all the activities he's doing with the victims, but obviously his MO, you know, jumping out of the bushes and grabbing victims, I refer to this as your trapdoor spider type of offender. And this is a very unsophisticated offender. And it's something that Paul Baxter was obviously comfortable doing. He's been successful all over Europe doing that type of attack. But the actual interactions with the victims, the actual sexual assault aspect, it appears that he's taking it to a certain level, and that's all he wanted at that moment. Now, he may have been interrupted. You know, you're talking over a span of 5 years. If he had been left out, could he have evolved where he's actually committing rape or homicide? That's a possibility. He just may be interrupted along the spectrum.
Yeah. There's a couple of things to unpack in there, but one of them is, at the time I thought, because Paul was only in Rossi for a limited time. If he had been in Rossi for a few years at a time, I think it maybe would have escalated. Who knows? But he was obviously transient in that he was being moved. So he was starting over all the time. As you say, Paul, maybe that was the gratification that he needed. 134 crimes were in that box. That 134 is only what was reported to the police. And in every walk of life, that's always, if not the tip of the iceberg, it's not the whole story.
So, Simon, you crack this case and the egg box is now case closed, all those 130 incidences, and it was nobody anybody thought even existed. What does that do to your reputation in this police force on the island?
Nobody had listened to anything I had to say at first because I was just a young boy. But after that, the DI phoned me every day. He never complained if I wasn't at my desk at 8 o'clock in the morning, like he was every morning. things changed quite dramatically. And especially what we started this conversation was a young man going to a strange place where he knew no one. I didn't know anybody in Isle of Bute, working with very seasoned police officers who'd been there for many, many years, and you had to earn some respect from them. And I think that's what I did. If I was in the pub thereafter and I said, I've got a thought about this, everybody would come over to listen to what Simon's thoughts were on it. So my stature grew as far as the recognition of my colleagues was concerned. And it was just the start of my career from there on. My life changed a bit after that. I had been in Rossi for about a year, maybe 14 months at that point. And 10 months after that, I was in the serious crime squad.
Wow. I just want to say, as we wrap this up, you mentioned the girl who was running away as you drive her around town with the female police officer. And then she says, oh, that looks like the guy, but it's not the guy, when she's looking at Contini. But the other two things that you noticed that somebody else might overlook are the fact that you know Contini is right-handed, and you deduce that this assault was probably conducted by somebody who's left-handed based on the fact that he grabs the girl with his right arm and then assaults her with his left hand, and that she mentions it was painful, he cut me with his fingers, and then you notice that Contini has perfectly manicured nails. I just feel like that is the kind of fantastic old-fashioned detective work that those of us on this side of the table live for. Really great.
It's why I love speaking to you guys, because you know that feeling when the penny drops and you argue against yourself because it's so obvious, isn't it?
Right. I just think it's fantastic. It's what, you know, Hollywood lives for as well when they're creating detective stories that are scripted. They're like, what are the tiny little things that a really good detective would notice? You know, why we loved Columbo, or Sherlock Holmes, who was the master of the most minor details.
Things we talk about over the years on this podcast is, to be a detective, you have to be inquisitive. And your first day, Simon, what do? You look underneath the desk and you go, what's that? And it's the egg box. And it's a perfect illustration of what I think good detectives are. They're just naturally inquisitive.
Right. And I see it, you know, Simon, where within any investigation, particularly like a whodunit series, you know, you have your subjective aspects, you have your objective facts, there's analytical skill sets, there's art. And you just demonstrated basically this combination of characteristics that you applied in order to solve this case. And I was thinking, how you solved this case, you used genealogy 40 years before we had used it in the Golden State Killer case. So amazing. Great job.
Yeah, very cool. Thank you, Simon.
Thank you.
Nice work.
Small Town Dicks was created by Detectives Dan and Dave. The podcast is produced by Jessica Halstead and me, Yardley Smith. Our senior editor is Soren Bajan, and our editors are Christina Bracamontes and Aaron Phelps. Our associate producers are The Real Nick Smitty and Aaron Gaynor. Gary Scott is our executive producer, and Logan Heftel is our production manager. Our books are cooked and cats wrangled by Ben Cornwell. And our social media maven is Monica Scott. It would make our day if you became a member of our small town fam by following us on Facebook, Instagram, and YouTube at Small Town Dicks. We love hearing from you. Oh, our groovy theme song was composed by John Forrest. Also, if you'd like to support the making of this podcast, hop on over to patreon.com/smalltowndickspodcast. There, for a small subscription fee, you'll find exclusive content you can't get anywhere else. The transcripts of this podcast are thanks to SpeechDocs, and they can be found on our website, smalltowndicks.com. Thank you, SpeechDocs, for this wonderful service. Small Town Dicks is an Audio 99 production. Small Town fam, thanks for listening. Nobody is better than you.